Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. Coming up later in today's program, Dayton Youth Radio, and we've got the scoop on Dayton History's Fight Night and this year's YWCA Women of Influence Awards. Up first, Ohio's heroin epidemic has pushed more children into state custody. As agencies saw about 1,000 additional cases over the year and a half, funding for those agencies has shrunk dramatically. From public radio station WOSU, Esther Honig visited Ross County, where nearly 90% of kids placed in foster homes are there because their parents struggle with addiction.
Ohio's heroin epidemic has pushed more children into state custody, as agencies saw about 1,000 additional cases over the last year and a half. Funding for those agencies has shrunk dramatically. In Ross County, almost 90% of kids placed in foster homes are there because their parents struggle with addiction. The sky is overcast as caseworker Jennifer Mills drives down a long, open road flanked by fields of yellow grass. Mills says most days she'll drive from one end of Ross County to the other, filing paperwork at the local courthouse or checking in on her cases. Many are parents struggling with addiction and kids living in foster homes. Mills has had this job for 3 years, and in that time, only two of her cases were not drug-related.
Drug cases are hard because you want them to want to be successful. And I think some of them really truly want to, but the drug's stronger than their desire.
Mills recalls parents who stayed clean for years, only to relapse and die from an overdose. Or a four-year-old boy who showed Mills how his mom would tie a tourniquet on her arm and shoot up with heroin.
On that particular case, there were needles found in his bedroom.
The drug epidemic has affected countless lives in Ohio, the most vulnerable being children. But Ohio ranks last in the country for the amount of state funding given to child protection services. In the last decade, that funding has fallen by 17%, or about $93 million. In Ohio, each county is responsible for their own child service agency. While wealthier urban areas can use money from property tax, rural areas tend to struggle. Jody Walker is the director of the child service agency that serves Ross, Vinton, and Hocking County. Walker says agencies like his rely heavily on tax levies if they can get voters to support them, or if they're lucky, the county commission.
But again, it becomes a local cost, and the state, you know, while they do give us an allocation, it doesn't go very far.
Walker says the number of cases are going up, and the cost of care for these kids is increasing. With a tight budget, the agency can do little to invest in programs for prevention.
At this point, we're just doing the day-to-day things right now and making sure kids are safe.
Drug cases tend to drag out longer. They require constant check-ins, drug screenings, and legal work. Many parents fail to overcome their opiate addiction and lose custody of their kids. In the last year, this small agency has lost 5 caseworkers due to burnout. Jennifer Mills says her cases don't always have a happy ending. That's why you have to feel called to this work.
This is definitely not a job that you go home at night and not think about it.
Mills checks in with one of her clients, a mother who recently lost custody of her 6 kids due to drug addiction. The young woman, Caroline, will use only her first name because her case is ongoing, has been clean for 8 months, and Mills says she's shown considerable improvement. Now, Caroline's fighting to keep custody of her newborn baby and prove she's overcome her past.
I love my kids, but did I do right? No. Did I keep messing up? Yes. Did I keep going back and failing drug tests? Yes.
Mills says her clients either love her or hate her. When Caroline struggled with addiction, it was Mills who had to carry out the court order to place her kids in foster care. But now that she's on the path to recovery, Caroline says Mills is helping her get one last chance at motherhood.
Jennifer and I, we've been rocky, but this one is way better. This case is way better. Of course, she's been a lot more understanding and helpful, actually, this time around.
Before she leaves, Mills checks the pantry to make sure there's food for the baby. And she swabs the inside of Caroline's mouth for random drug screening. Caroline can still become one of Mills' success stories. For those, she says she typically earns a thank you. For Ohio Public Radio, I'm Esther Honig.
This week in Dayton Youth Radio, we feature the second of a 3-part series where Miami Valley teenagers discuss race. Here's project manager Basim Blunt.
We have a history of mistrust between African Americans and our nation's police officers, who have been sworn to enforce the laws. In times of slavery, Jim Crow, legalized segregation, and now the war on drugs. Today we have two high school seniors, Travis Grile and Mandela Brown, who decided to tell their personal stories. Next week we'll hear from Travis, but today we'll hear from Mandela Brown.
It was a summer night, and only 9 p.m. My three friends and I had gone to get ice cream, but Trey didn't have cash, so we went to the Right Path Credit Union so he could use the ATM. The sirens blared as we walked down the sidewalk, breaking the silence of peaceful suburbia. My friends and I covered our eyes from the lights that lit up the night sky like a firecracker on the 4th of July. As I licked my ice cream cone, I knew instantly what was about to happen. The cop, who was white, exited the car. I told my friends to step back and to shut up and to let me do the talking. The officer told us that there had been a complaint about four black males causing a public disturbance in the area. This cop wasn't aggressive with us, but he wasn't friendly either. He wanted to know why we were in the area, and he told us to go home immediately. My friends truly could not believe how we could be seen as a threat. But me, I wasn't surprised, because we're seen as animals, as less than human, as dangerous. I know what I'm talking about because I've been dealing with police since I was 13. My first serious encounter was in middle school, after a Friday Night Lights football game. All the kids were walking up to Graders, a popular hangout in warm and cheerful Centerville, and I wanted to catch up with some friends on the other side of the street. They were hanging out at Panera Bread. I didn't cross at the lights like any other suburban teenager. I jaywalked. But I was a black teenager. That warranted it for me to be arrested and put in handcuffs in front of everyone to see. I was only 13, mind you. I thought I was going to die. How would you feel if you got slammed up against a cop car at the age of 13 with handcuffs on? How would you feel? Would you feel good? Would you laugh? Would you joke around? It went to court, and it was thrown out, with the judge saying it was the silliest case he had ever seen. In my sophomore year, I was selling fundraiser cards for my high school track team. It was a brisk February night, and my overeager little brother tagged along to help me. We got through 15 houses without a problem, until I saw those ever-familiar flashing lights approaching us. And I just thought, not again. Really? I'm doing something good. I'm trying to help the community. I am working for my track coach to sell these cards so I can get these t-shirts. But then the officer exited the car slowly, and this is what made it worse. His hand was on his holster. His eyes locked on my hands. But he never gave me a reason why I was being questioned or why I was being stopped. But just like any other time, he said, go home immediately. But do I get angry? Yes. Do I get mad? Yes. Yes, I believe I'm treated unfairly in this country. Yes, I wish things were better. And yes, I believe that police overstep their boundaries as law enforcement. But that does not give me the right to fire back. Because that makes me just as bad as my oppressor. I'd rather choose the harder right over the easier wrong any day, because that makes me better. My parents taught me from a very young age to avoid confrontations with police, because like I said earlier, even the smallest sight of anger could cause a more dangerous and possibly fatal situation to occur. Myself, I come from a privileged background. My father's a doctor. My mom's a nurse. I feel like they named me Mandela for a reason. A man of peace. Not all cops are bad, and not all black men are innocent. I'll admit that. But this endless bloodshed must stop, because our country is being split into two. I don't want to have to teach my sons to look out for cops like my father did. I want the sign of a police officer to make him feel safe, to make him feel comfortable. I want him to be able to go up to a police officer and say, "Officer, I need your help." I don't want him to run from a cop, and I don't want him to have to fear them.
That's part one of a story entitled, We Are All Americans, produced by Mandela Brown. Special thanks to Tricia Rapock, broadcasting teacher at Centerville High School. Listen to the second half of this story, produced by Mandela's classmate at Centerville, Travis Grile, whose dad is a police officer. For Dayton Youth Radio, This is Project Manager Basine Blunt.
Support for Dayton Youth Radio on WYSO comes from the Virginia W. Kettering Foundation and the Armott Boyer Charitable Trust, Fifth Third Bank Trustee. I'm Jerry Kenny. This is WYSO Weekend. On February 25th at Memorial Hall, Dayton History will host Fight Night, an evening of boxing. Muhammad Ali, Jack Dempsey, and other boxing legends have battled it out inside the hall, and this event keeps that tradition alive. To get the details, we spoke with Jeff Brown, founder of the Brown Institute of Martial Arts in Centerville, who's been training the athletes for their fights.
We've been in business now for 25 years. I'm pretty excited about that. And we do offer 50 classes a week in five different curriculums of martial arts, including Muay Thai and Gracie Jiu-Jitsu, Southeast Asian martial arts, traditional martial arts, combatives, and self-defense training.
Did you get into martial arts as a young boy?
I certainly did. My father was a naval officer, and we moved around a lot, so he always enrolled me in a different martial arts school. I've been doing martial arts since I was 5 years old.
We've got the Dayton History Fight Night on Saturday, February 25th.
I'm so excited to be part of Dayton History. Dayton has a great big history of service, and Memorial Hall was really put together, I believe, after the end of the Civil War to commemorate the courage of all the soldiers and everything else, and to have a place, too, to have different events here in Dayton as it was a bustling town. And so the Dayton History took over Memorial Hall, and they're utilizing it now as a fundraiser to help preserve Dayton's history and culture, and many, many famous boxing matches actually took place there, including Muhammad Ali, Joe Frazier, other famous fighters, all fought in that particular place. So it's got a lot of history in it, which is really neat. So the fight's going to be on February the 25th, and I'm really excited, too, about the fighters that are doing it because they're all amateur guys. These are all people from local businesses and so on that were sponsored, and they've had to train pretty hard. And getting in front of 1,000 people or so and fighting is pretty scary stuff, so I think they got a lot of courage, and I'm very proud of all of them.
How long has the training been going on?
We started probably the end of December. It's usually mid-December, end of December. But, you know, trying to get people together and organized and committed to doing it, it's kind of hard to do, so Dayton History did a great job doing that. So I'd say about 2 months.
So why are these men and women putting themselves in front of a crowd of 1,000 and letting themselves get beat up a little?
That's a very good question. Well, one is to pay tribute to I think the soldiers and what Memorial Hall is all about and what Dayton History is all about. But fighting can be a very cathartic experience. I mean, putting yourself out there and dealing with that adrenal gland response, someone's trying to knock your block off, and being able to maintain your emotional intensity and protect yourself and learn how to protect yourself is very intense, and I encourage everyone to do that, obviously. Yes.
What kind of changes have you seen people go through from the time they start training to the time they complete their match?
It is interesting. I really see a big increase in their self-confidence. At first, when they come in, they don't know what to expect. They don't want to get slapped around or beat up. But we have a really organized curriculum here. It's very safe. It's fun. Weight loss is a big part of it. I've seen people lose weight. I've seen them gain self-confidence and athleticism. And knowing that you know how to protect yourself is very empowering. Not like I'm going to walk around and threaten people by any means. But, in fact, you have a real quiet assurance instead. Kind of like the saying, speak softly and carry a big stick.
Let's talk a little bit more about your organization. How many people are you training here currently?
I probably have approximately 150 students. We have both kids and adults curriculums throughout the day, and we're actually open 6 days a week. And we offer classes in five different curriculums. Fantastic children's program. But I'd say we got about 50% of my clients are adults, actually, which I think speaks a lot about the integrity of our art and how many champions we've produced and all the different systems we do.
And, Jeff, where can folks find out more information about this event, get tickets?
You can get tickets at Dayton History downtown at Carolyn Park, here at Brown Institute of Martial Arts. Tidal Boxing and Bricks Ice Company are all places that you can get tickets at. The website is DaytonFightNight.com, and, of course, you can probably go to the Dayton History website as well. You can get information about the Brown Institute at browninstitute.com, and we're located right here in Centerville. It's going to be a really exciting event because not only are these going to be great fights to watch, but it's got a 1920s flair. So everybody's kind of dressing up like it's the 1920s and so on. There's a cash bar. There's also going to be a band and a big party afterwards down in the basement, which is super, super fun. And there's food vendors and food trucks. It's a great event, a great place to bring a date and have a wonderful evening.
Great. Sounds like a great time. Again, that's the Dayton History Fight Night on Saturday, February 25th. Jeff Brown, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kitty.
And many music fans across the region this week are mourning the loss of one of Dayton's most influential funk music pioneers. Walter Juni Morrison was one of the original members of the Ohio Players. He also played keyboards with the band Funkadelic. Morrison's daughter announced the 62-year-old's death on Facebook. The social media post prompted dozens of fans, friends, and family members to post their personal memories of Morrison's influence on music history. Now, WISO's Behind the Groove music host, Maseem Blunt, offers his own remembrance of Morrison.
A graduate of Roosevelt High School, Juni, as he was affectionately known, was a child prodigy. He could play any instrument you put in front of him. He joined the Players as a teenager and co-wrote the band's first breakout single. Juni was also a true genius at songwriting. The band's second hit, Funky Worm, gives us a sense of his playful and witty approach to music.
What? Say it now. Yeah. Say it now. Yeah. Me and the Ohio Players gonna tell you about a worm. He's the funkiest worm in the world. Okay, say it, fellas.
Morrison left the Ohio Players in 1974. He found lukewarm success as a solo artist until he met music icon George Clinton. Clinton recruited Juni to join Parliament Funkadelic, where he became the band's music director and penned one of the biggest dance floor anthems in music history. Remembrances are pouring in all over social media from musicians like Dr. Dre, Questlove, and Solange Knowles. Juni's songs have been a major influence on music history and dance floors for several generations. So here's to Juni. My brother, thank you for helping us realize that we are all one nation under a groove. For WYSO, this is Radio Maseem.
And for some additional perspective, we talked to David Webb, the CEO of the Dayton Funk Music Hall of Fame. He starts with a breakdown of what they're all about.
Our mission and goal is to educate the public's knowledge in the history of funk music on the one, the genre of funk music collective, soul and rhythm, geared for our young people of all ages.
Give us a quick comment about funk music history in Dayton and how they're tied together.
Well, Dayton is the birthplace of funk, and James Brown started the funk music genre, and then followed by George Clinton, Guy and the Family Stone, and their genre of music. And it just broadened the big picture in Dayton, Ohio. And then from there, that's when the Ohio Players came in effect in the early 70s with their big hits like Skin Tight and Pain and Funky Worm. And that's what set Dayton apart of all the rest of the groups.
And Juni Morrison putting the pen to many of those song lyrics.
Yes, he was the big thing on Funky Worm, the voice of Funky Worm, the grandmother, and says, me and the Ohio Player is going to tell you about a worm. It's the funkiest worm in it all. He has that voice of that. Also, he wrote a lot of songs for Parliament Funkadelic. One of his big hits, as you know, was One Nation Under a Groove, where he was telling Sugarfoot, you know, hey, look what I did when I left the Ohio Players.
Let's talk about his influence on funk music overall.
Oh, he's a big part. Songs like Atomic Dog, stuff that he wrote for George Clinton and wrote for different people. His sound and style of music was great. I spoke to Juni early in December and early in January, and he's sending us one of his keyboards that he did a lot of the hits on. He wrote us a letter of recommendation and letter of approval that he stands behind the Funk Music Hall of Fame Exhibition Center. It was so great hearing his voice. Then when I heard the news that he passed away, it made my heart very, very sad because he was writing a record. Him and George Clinton was collaborating on a record of Parliament Funkadelic, which has been coming out this year. So I'm really, really sad to hear about that.
Thanks for getting back to us. Any final comments on the Ohio Players or anything that you have going on there?
Well, as you know, the Funk Music Hall of Fame Exhibition Center is doing great things. Coming up this spring, we'll be opening up the Funk Music Hall of Fame Exhibition Center at 113 East 3rd Street, downtown Dayton, in the Fire Block District. If people want to know more about the Funk Music Hall of Fame Exhibition Center, please go to our website at www.thefunkcenter.org. That's www.thefunkcenter.org. Or give us a call at 937-837-4441. And let's keep it funky.
David Webb, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Thanks so much for joining us. Each year, YWCA Dayton celebrates women who are making a big difference in people's lives. The annual Women of Influence Awards ceremony takes place on March 9th at the Dayton Convention Center. Here's YWCA CEO Shannon Isom to talk about it.
The Women of Influence Award is now our, this is our 20th year of this award, so pretty exciting. We have now reached a major milestone where we've recognized well into 150 honorees to date of women that have very purposefully and conscientiously not only served our mission, but changed our very community.
And can we talk about this year's recipients?
Yeah, absolutely. So our honoree class, anniversary class, includes Amanda Wright Lane, International Aviation Advocate, Carmen Gooden, who is the co-founder and executive director for Linda Vista Incorporated, Sandy Gudorf, the president of Downtown Dayton Partnership, Michelle Riley, the CEO of the Food Bank, Judy Cook, the former mayor of the city of Oakwood, Major Wendy Stiver with Dayton Police Department, Stacy Thompson Spear Hardy, the vice president, as well as the regional manager for corporate responsibility of banking for Key Bank. And then our lifetime achievement award is Jodine Blunden, who is the founder of DCDC. Nominations were open this year from March 11th to September 16th. We kept it open a little while longer. It paid off. We had a little over 70 applicants, people that nominate others. So these aren't people that are nominating themselves. These are people that are nominating others for this honor. And we have women in our community that meet and decide who are our 7 to 8 honorees. And then I get the great job of being able to call more than not a very surprised group of women to congratulate them on not only the nomination, but being chosen for this.
You talked a little bit about the qualities that have put these women in the spotlight. Talk about the impact that they have directly on the communities that you serve.
We are very dedicated to ensuring that we have a good swath of women that represent, again, our community, our programming, more importantly, our mission, and that at any point in time, the 800 people that come and fill the seats there for the Dayton Convention Center, that any young lady, business professional, even a client, resident, and men as well, families can look upon those women and say, gosh, you know, I see myself, or I see my story, or I see where they've helped our community. So for many of the women, from an aviation advocate, which I think strongly not only supports our community, but really does support our mission of promoting a more peaceful world, a more peaceful community, all the way to and through those people who are really advocating in the trenches. So Michelle Riley, as being a part of the food bank, feeding many, many thousands of people across our community, many here that we serve within the YWCA, all the way to Carmen Gooden, who has founded an organization that really focuses on sexual assault and victims of sexual assault, again, of which that not only the food bank serves, but the YWCA serves, all the way to and through the police and the banking that provides housing and community responsibility. So all of these women have touched the mission, but more importantly, many of these women who have touched programming and residents and clients in which we serve.
You offer counseling, supportive services, and emergency protective sheltering for women and children. Those numbers, are they trending up? Are they staying even? What's going on here in the Miami Valley?
Sure. In the Miami Valley, in our county, we continue to see trends upwards. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that shelter services trend upwards, and it does go back and forth, depending on actually time and season. More than anything, we know that because we shelter well over 500 women and children in any given year, that the services are needed. So the trend of up or down is something that we certainly look at, but we are is at least important as the fact that we have those services ready and handy for our community right here. We provide a hotline that is open 24 hours a day, where we're providing someone 365 days a year, answering the phone around shelter, answering the phone around any type of crisis, urgent care with violence, and that doesn't necessarily mean physical. It could be intimate partner violence, around emotional, financial, as well as physical violence. Likewise, we have within our services across Preble County and here within Montgomery County services that if anyone walks through those doors, that we are able to provide the emergency safety net services need, which includes security 24 hours a day, food that we serve three meals, hot meals every day, making sure that the 40-plus children that we have within the shelter get off into schooling and that there's no slippage within transitions, especially within crisis. We offer many multitudes of things, from food to any type of incidentals, and that is all done not only from grant but by the generosity of people that support the YWCA and its programming.
And in 2016, you had more than 3,100 calls through your crisis hotline. Do you see an increase there in the immediate needs?
Yeah, so we continue to see the same issues that we have seen, but I believe that they're more acute. So the immediate needs that we continue to have is shelter. And that may not need to be a long stay. It could be a short stay than just to provide support and help as they move and transition to a more stable environment. We still need and see, and I believe this is a Montgomery County issue, very much like a lot of the counties across the country, affordable housing. And so as I'm transitioning from one place to another, am I able to be in a place that's safe? Am I able to be in a community that supports my children, that supports my needs, that has transportation, and that I can afford? So housing is an immediate need, sheltering is an immediate need, and then likewise, any type of safety net value. So we can make sure that we connect women and children with food services, with clinical care, mental health services. We're doing a lot more with drug addiction therapy and counseling, which I think we see that across many counties across Ohio. These are the immediate needs that not only that we see in the county, but we see at the YW. Likewise, because of that, administrative staff is key. It's important. Having subject matter experts ready on hand for a place that's open 24 hours a day, we want to make sure that we're greeting with the delivery of services at 4 a.m. It's the same that we do at 4 p.m. That takes staff, that takes resources, that takes funding. So we want to make sure that we are providing the same level of care at all times. That's why our signature event, like Women of Influence, is so important. It is our lead fundraising event. 100% of those proceeds go directly back into our programming.
The Women of Influence Awards for 2017 takes place on March 9th at the Dayton Convention Center. And is this open to the public?
Yeah, it is open to the public. There's a couple of ways in which you can get more information, buy tickets. We like to say that the easiest way to do it is on your phone. Everyone seems to have a mobile phone. You can dial right into ywcadayton.org. Whether it's on your phone or your desktop, it'll take you right to our landing page and you can buy a ticket there. Also, continuing to look for sponsorship of businesses, we offer a table of eight for sponsorships. You can, again, go online, but also feel free to call us if you don't have access to a computer or that feels a little cumbersome. 461-5550. We have, again, someone to answer phone calls 24 hours a day, and they'll walk you through the process.
Shannon Isom, CEO with YWCA Dayton, thanks so much for your time today.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having us.
That's it for this edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. I'm Jerry Kenny. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 10. Coming up next on WYSO, it's Vic McCunis with the Book Nook.